Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Paston. Steph is off enjoying herself on some secret mission, which she'll share with us, I hope, in a few weeks' time. So you've just got me for the time being. Actually, it's not just me. As you know, we have just put out our mini-series, our thrilling thriller of a mini-series, Who Killed Liz Truss? And guess what? Today, I've got Liz Truss here, and I'm going to be posing the question to her in the financial and political mayhem of her 49-50 days as Prime Minister. Who was it that killed her? Liz Truss, very good to see you. I thought we could pick up where our podcast series, Who Killed Liz Truss, left off. In it, I said that before the mini-budget, no one had told you or your Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, about this £1 trillion pool of risk, which meant that if government bond prices fell, that would lead to forced sales by pension funds, or rather these LDI funds, which they controlled, of government bonds, which would lead to a financial crisis for the government. And that financial crisis played out in an extreme form. Is it correct that until after the mini budget, nobody at the Bank of England or the Treasury had told you or the Chancellor anything about this massive financial risk?
Well, that is true. Until I heard about the problems on the Monday after the mini budget, I'd never even heard of an LDI. I didn't know what this was. The whole thing had to be explained to me. And I've subsequently spoken to Kwasi, and he was not aware of the tinderbox either.
And if you'd been told about the enormous financial risk that you would be running with your mini budget as a result of this pool of risk, would you have modified your plans?
Well, I think if I'd known about the tinderbox that was there, I would have insisted, and I'm sure Kwasi would have insisted, that that was dealt with first. And I think it's worth pointing out that as well as the mini budget on Friday, we also had the Governor of the Bank of England on the night before the mini budget announcing a huge gilt sale, which also contributed to the febrile situation that on top of what we later discovered was a tinderbox. So the Bank of England themselves, I think, ought to have been sorting out the LDI issue before announcing the sale of government bonds. So it seems to me that, you know, one of the key roles the Bank of England was given was maintaining financial stability. And they clearly didn't do that. Not did they just not do that. They either didn't know about the problems themselves, or they most certainly didn't tell the Treasury about those problems. And of course, if I'd known the chain of events, the part the mini budget played in it, you know, we would have been looking at how do we deal with this £1 trillion issue first. But we simply didn't know about it.
I, on the whole, am a believer in the great British tradition of cock-up rather than conspiracy. And it seems to me that that decision by the Bank of England at the Monetary Policy Committee meeting the day before the mini budget to sell all those gilts, tens of billions of pounds worth of government bonds, shows how ignorant the Bank of England was about this massive pool of risk. And if that's the case, what do you think should have happened subsequently to hold the Bank of England to account? Because it has two primary responsibilities. One is monetary stability, keeping inflation low, and the other is financial stability, avoiding crises just like this one. And, you know, it's had that responsibility throughout its multi-hundred-year history, but that responsibility was given much more force by George Osborne when he was Chancellor. This looks like a grotesque failure of its regulatory responsibilities.
Well, I believe it is just that. And I think what's worse is rather than front that up, the governor immediately sought to blame the mini budget for what had happened. And you know, I think that is a very, very difficult position for a politician to find themselves in. First of all, because we were playing catch up, not knowing about the LDI issue at all. We were scrambling to explain what had happened when it was completely unexpected. And secondly, their failure to properly explain that to the world at large was what happened on that Monday and Tuesday. And to this day, I don't know the extent. I mean, you asked a question, Robert. Did the Monetary Policy Committee know on the Friday? Were they aware of this? I don't know the answer to that question. And I do think it's extraordinary because many independent economists have said this was the major cause of that financial instability was the LDI crisis. You know, there has not been an investigation of who knew what when, who told other people that this was a problem. And we formulated the mini budget working with Treasury officials, you know, and throughout those mini budget discussions, we considered all kinds of options about what should be included or not included. The Treasury officials were clear that this was not going to, you know, precipitate a major event. We obviously knew that the cost of government borrowing was going up. You know, we knew that interest rates were going up, but there was no sense in which, you know, this could precipitate a crisis. And in fact, what they said to me, what I was told on the Friday afternoon after the mini budget, is that what had happened in the markets had been slightly worse than the, you know, the worst end of their expectations, but it certainly wasn't a situation they perceived to be difficult then. So that was on Friday after the mini budget. It was slightly worse than their expectations, but in no way was it extraordinary or leading to a difficult situation.
So gilt prices fall very significantly on the Monday. And actually, my Bank of England sources tell me that at a senior level within the Bank of England, they were not aware of the looming forced sales of gilts by pension funds, the LDI crisis, until that Monday when the markets desk of the Bank of England started telling their bosses what was going on. So it is extraordinary. There are questions for the Bank of England to answer about why they couldn't see this coming. But you pointed out that interest rates were rising anyway. And what we had around the world was inflation taking off, interest rates rising more or less everywhere, certainly in the developing world, and therefore government bond prices, US government bonds, Eurozone bonds, our bonds, all falling anyway, irrespective of the LDI crisis. And therefore, one significant criticism of what you and Kwasi did in cutting taxes, but without cutting public spending, it's what people call unfunded tax cuts. The Treasury calculated that that was going to increase borrowing by $45 billion a year within 5 years, which is a big increase in borrowing. One criticism was that you would be forcing up interest rates even more than was otherwise going to be the case because investors were anyway going to react negatively to all this increased borrowing.
So first of all, I think it's worth looking at the package we announced. The vast majority of it was not raising taxes rather than cutting taxes.
But it was so still creating a hole in the public finances.
I will sort of answer that point, but I do think it's an important distinction, because what was happening is corporation tax was scheduled to go up from 19 to 25%. And you're right, the Treasury costed that, the overall package over 5 years, of costing $45 billion.
Well, now, it was everything. It wasn't just that, it was everything.
Yeah, the overall package. But I believe those figures were fundamentally wrong, because I don't believe that the Treasury, or indeed the Office of Budget Responsibility, take into account behavioural effects enough of tax changes. And, you know, we saw AstraZeneca move their headquarters elsewhere. You know, we've seen the income from corporation tax not being as much as the Treasury predicted. So I and Kwasi have a fundamental disagreement with the Office of Budget Responsibility and what I describe as the Treasury orthodoxy about whether or not tax raises actually raise the money that they are expected to raise. And if you look at recent borrowing figures, the projections of the OBR have turned out to be wrong on borrowing. So the logic of what we were doing was to seek to increase economic growth by keeping taxes down where that would have an impact, getting rid of taxes like the 45p rate that were not contributing to the exchequer or economic growth, and deregulating. Say, for example, getting on with fracking, creating investment zones where it is easier to build houses. And our plan was to restrain public spending. So if you look at what we were proposing versus what's happened, public spending has actually increased, I think, by $17 billion in the first year and then $18 billion in the following year. So what we were doing is holding down public spending, not increasing welfare by as much as now has been, which would have also saved a further £8 billion. The difficulty I had, to be frank, Robert, is politically, it's hard to advertise that you're not going to increase spending, because that creates a massive outcry. We already had Conservative MPs, you know, sitting on the government benches who objected to putting welfare up by prices and not wages. So we had to be sotto voce about some of those plans. And this was the difficult balancing act that we had to do. But if you look at the policies we wanted to put in place, holding down public spending, so not increasing it in any areas, forcing departments to find savings within their own budgets, only increasing welfare by wages, not prices, and getting extra revenue in from the fact that we weren't raising taxes, I believe that the deficit would be in a better position now than it has been under the alternative. So I have a fundamental disagreement with the way the Office of Budget Responsibility calculates its forecasts and the way the Treasury look at these issues. And where we are now is we've had, you know, 20, 25 years of this economic orthodoxy, and it's resulted in stagnation. You know, the government spending 45% of GDP and record high taxes. And Kwasi kept saying the same thing, which is you cannot tax your way to growth. That is basically the Treasury philosophy.
Look, there's so much there to unpack, and I'm going to come back to quite a lot of it. But I want to make two points. One is, there is no serious economist who argues that tax cuts pay for themselves. Yes, there is an argument about, you know, essentially the size of a deficit that may be caused when you cut taxes. Or indeed, there's an argument about how much tax will be raised when you increase taxes, because of course there are behavioural issues. Of course, when taxes go up, some businesses choose not to invest or they choose to relocate. And of course, when taxes are cut, you sometimes get a bigger or smaller benign effect in terms of investment. But there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that when you cut taxes, it doesn't cost you money in terms of increased borrowing for several years. So the criticism that would be made is not about your overall package. It's about the fact that you put the cart before the horse, in the sense that if you had done your planning reform first, if you'd announced reform of welfare first, if you'd announced your reforms to the way the civil service works to save money from, you know, keeping the growth in public spending down first, they would have created the conditions that would have allowed you at a later point, maybe not so many months later, but they would have created the conditions for you to cut taxes and not spook the market. So do you at least accept the criticism that you just did what you wanted to do in totally the wrong order, and that actually blew up all your plans.
So I want to address the first point you made. I'm not arguing that, you know, tax cuts fund themselves. I'm not arguing that. But if you look at the economic forecast prepared by the CBR, you know, you were talking about the £40 billion cost of these policies by the Treasury. Well, the CBR estimated it was £25 billion. So you have a credible economic forecaster saying the cost is roughly half of what the Treasury projected it would be. And that's important because something like corporation tax, if you raise corporation tax, it brings in more in the first few years, but then companies' behaviour starts to change. They locate their office elsewhere. They find ways of getting around the tax, and you bring in less over the five-year period. And what we were very clear about, and Kwasi laid this out, is that our plans would deliver the target of debt falling over 5 years. Now, we did announce supply-side reforms alongside the tax.
But I'm saying you didn't do them. If you'd done them first, that, you know, the entire political and economic environment would have been different.
So we were in 2022. So first of all, I announced we'd already said we were going to do fracking. We'd already said we were going to do the investment zones, which would have resulted in more house building, the removal of planning restrictions, the removal of environmental restrictions. We announced that in the growth budget, the so-called mini budget. The reality is, for a planning reform...
But announcing with something like planning reform, I mean, it's not the same as actually doing it. And what I'm saying is, you have to make progress towards doing these things to give investors confidence that they're actually going to happen. And so lots of your colleagues...
I am trying to answer your question. I was going to answer about three questions ago. For you keep putting new questions to me.
But it's the same question. It is just that we do have a bit of a disagreement about this.
Let me answer this, because the investment zones, we wanted to get them going as quickly as possible. So we were in September 2022. Realistically, the spades would only start going in the ground the following summer. And that was with a fair wind. Likewise with fracking, you know, when are you going to start seeing the improvements in energy prices? Well, that is going to take some time to feed through. We wanted to do the North Sea licenses straight away, get rid of the windfall tax, open those things up. But most supply side reform, you are not going to start to see improvements before about 2 years. And we were in 2024. And what we wanted to show is, after the British economy had been in stagnation for quite some time, we wanted to show the improvements that spades would go in the ground. Now, if we had waited for those things to fully take effect, for the houses to be built, for the oil to be extracted, for all of those supply side reforms to feed through, we'd be in 2025 at the earliest. We'd have had high corporation tax for 2 years ahead of, well, first of all, the general election, but also ahead of, you know, companies making decisions to invest in the UK. And I fundamentally believe that that was damaging our economic growth. So if you take the CBR estimate of what the cost was, Robert, the £25 billion, how were we going to fund that in the classical terms you make out? Well, we weren't going to spend an extra £17 billion of public spending. We were going to not go above existing budgets. We were going to save £7 billion on our welfare budget, which was, you know, incremental. That money would have built up each year. That is how we were planning to pay for that overall package. But the problem we've got is we've got a forecasting agency that doesn't really believe in the behavioural impact of taxes. And we've also got a forecasting agency in the OBR that doesn't really believe in the positive benefits of supply side reform and the cost of regulation.
I'm not sure about that. But what you are playing is essentially a pick a number game. £25 billion, says the CBR. You know, £45 to £50 billion, says the Treasury. At a later date, we are pretty sure the OBR was on £70 billion. But I think, in a way,
it's not irrelevant. Look, I am trying to answer the question.
All forecasts are, by definition, wrong. What we agree on is that tax cuts don't pay for themselves. And I'm not saying, you know, that you should have waited 2 years before making tax cuts or reforming the tax system. I'm simply saying that, and this is a point that some of your colleagues make, you kept saying your hero was Margaret Thatcher. She did things step by step. And the argument is she would have done the supply side reform first and given people confidence it was happening before she cut taxes. And you should remember that in the early years of her premiership, she put taxes up.
I don't think these comparisons are particularly relevant. I mean, I really don't, because the situation we were in is over the period of the past decades, we'd seen stagnant growth.
Yeah.
Why have we got stagnant growth in Britain? Answer, taxes are too high. The state is too big. There's too much regulation.
Liz, there's tons more to put to you. You have no idea how many burning questions I need to ask. Come back in a minute or two.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
You and I completely agree that the status quo was unsustainable, that we have had...
I still haven't answered your question.
You are going to answer it in a second, but the economic stagnation was plainly, economically, the biggest problem we faced, and simply doing what we'd been doing for years wasn't going to solve it. Now, it's important for people listening to this to recognise that there are alternative views about what you do to shake things up.
And can I answer the question about the alternative view? Because there are economists like Doug McWilliams and Patrick Mumford who believe that if we had continued with our plans, the economy would be growing faster and we'd be dealing with the deficit better now.
And there are plenty of economists who completely disagree.
Those are the ones that I think are wrong. And I think they are the establishment economists in Britain, and they are very, very powerful. But it's not true to say there are no economists who agree with me.
I didn't say that. But even Doug and Patrick would almost certainly agree that sequencing of these sorts of reforms matters. And as I say, you know, even taking at face value that much of what you were doing could well over time have increased the growth rate, there is still this fundamental question. I mean, I happen to believe that there's a very strong argument for saying you simply did it in the wrong order.
I don't agree with that, because if you look at where we were in autumn 2022, and the corporation tax is for me the biggest, there were all sorts of other changes we made, but the corporation tax was the single biggest measure, and it was the measure I was forced to reverse pretty much at gunpoint. That measure was due to come in April 2023, and we were there in September. I'd been arguing against this tax raise for several years because I thought it was a very bad idea. It was a very bad symbol of Britain's competitiveness after Brexit to say we're going to raise corporation tax. Just when other countries were lowering it, we were becoming less dynamically competitive in the world.
But we were giving massive incentives to businesses through the super deduction of capital investment. The fact that they could claim tons of tax back for big investment, that was a positive.
But the headline rate was a massive problem. And many corporates will tell you it is a massive problem. And many small businesses will tell you it is a problem. So in order to get the British economy growing, in order to attract investment, we can see what is now happening to investment in Britain, it was vital, I believed, to cut corporation tax now, or rather not raise it. I did not expect a negative reaction from, you know, and in fact, there was a positive reaction from business organisations on the day of the mini budget. And what Treasury officials had told us about our plans is they had an expectation of the market impact. They didn't expect, because they didn't know about the LDI issue, that it would create a major problem. So we had a plan that we believed to be right, that leading economists like Mimford and Doug McWilliams and others believed to be correct. We put that plan forward. It was well received by many business organizations. The reason that the plan didn't go ahead wasn't because of the plan itself. It was because of the market reaction on the LDI issue. And okay. I ask you a counterfactual, Robert, that if there wasn't 1 trillion of LDIs that had not been properly presided over, you know, do you think we would have seen that reaction on Monday?
It definitely wouldn't have been as extreme. And of course, we are in this counterfactual world where it's impossible to know. You know, there would, I'm pretty sure, in that environment of government bond prices falling across the world, I'm pretty sure that the price of government bonds in the UK would have continued to fall, interest rates would have continued to rise, people's mortgage rates would have continued to rise. Whether they would have risen to the level that made it completely unsustainable for you to continue employing quasi-quarting and continuing with your budget policies, that's very unclear. I do think, and this is the point where you and I sort of agree, okay, one of the things that I've been sort of focused on for many, many, many years is how investors make their decisions in a globalized economy where finance is global. And the reason you were so vulnerable is because at a time when interest rates are rising all over the world, at a time when bond prices are falling all over the world, the big money is made by investors who identify what I think of as the sort of, you know, the ugliest, in this case, country in the room, the country that is most vulnerable. And the reason the LDI pool of risk was so damaging for the UK in the context of your mini budget is for those investors, hedge funds, the UK, after the mini budget, with the LDI problem, became a one-way bet. And what happens when investors target, essentially, you know, they are hunters, right? You see the wounded prey and you think, I'm going to kill that, right? And the problem that you had was that because of the combination of the mini budget and the LDI pool of risk, we were the wounded prey. And at that point, investors just pile in. They just think, okay, we can kill this and make an absolute fortune. If you're short selling in those circumstances, you make a fortune. And then if you happen to hold this stuff and you don't want to suffer losses, you just dump all this stock. You dump all these assets. You dump gilts. And that was why this was such a dangerous moment for the country and for you.
I think the other, you know, of course, there was the LDI factor, but there was also the factor that clearly the economic establishment, including the Bank of England and, you know, Treasury officials briefing journalists, the Office of Budget Responsibility having their forecast leaked. You know, it was clear.
You'd upset a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was clear. You had basically upset a lot of people. You know, in the leadership election, I said that I felt that the way monetary policy had been enacted, I called for a review of the Bank of England's remit. I said that I thought the OBR's forecasting processes were wrong and that the Treasury orthodoxy was a problem. So, yes, I mean, maybe it was a mistake to be honest about what I thought before taking these forces on. But the fact is that rather than backing the government up, which should be the responsibility of the Bank of England, it should be using monetary policy in concert with fiscal policy. It should be maintaining financial confidence. You know, the Office of Budget Responsibility's forecast should not be entering the public domain via the front page of newspapers, and Treasury officials should not be leaking and briefing. But this is very important as to why people perceive the government as prey, because they could see that the people who were meant to be working for us were not on our side. And that is a problem. And the second issue was that Conservative or some Conservative MPs were also not signed up to a programme of supply-side economics and fiscal restraint. And they made that very clear in the media as well. So I felt back in 2022, which is why I put myself forward in the leadership election in the first place, is that we needed a significant change in our economic policy. That the country was stagnating, that taxes were at a 70-year high, that the government was getting bigger and bigger, and we needed to take on that orthodoxy. And, you know, you've given the alternative scenario, Robert. If we'd announced planning reform and we'd announced fracking, I mean, good luck trying to get a fracking vote through Parliament. But, you know, if I'd have done those things first, but at the same time raised corporation tax in April, what kind of message would that send to investors?
Yes, it's completely plausible. And this is indeed what Margaret Thatcher did, was to announce a path for the medium to long term of tax reform.
We had 2 years to the end of Parliament. And, you know, it was a very different situation in the 70s when there'd been a long run up to a general election. There'd been a winter of discontent. Very different situation to the situation we were facing now. I mean, I think it's a fair point for people to make that it's simply impossible to deliver the type of economic policies I wanted to deliver, given the current political and economic environment in Britain. That's a fair point. But I don't think the idea that we could have announced fracking and planning in the autumn, raised taxes and then announced we were cutting them a year later, I don't think that is a plausible scenario that could have happened.
Well, look, lots of people would agree that we've got to deal with this planning issue, which makes it incredibly difficult for businesses to build the plant they need, the buildings they need, to build houses, to build infrastructure. We've got a massive planning problem here, and it's faintly depressing to hear you say, actually, that you're really pessimistic that you could have achieved any progress on that. But on fracking, I mean, obviously, I have to, because I mean, there'll be lots of people shouting at this podcast. I think it is important to point out two things. One is, as you say, on fracking itself, you know, split your own party. I mean, you'd be, as you say, we did have a vote on your last day before you resigned. We had a vote. You know, there was turmoil in the House of Commons. And it's partly turmoil, partly because of people worried about the environmental costs, and partly because actually the evidence, I know you believe that there's this great source of potential cheap energy for the UK, but it's not proven. So I do think quite often when you talk about fracking, there are all sorts of other things that you could have done and you talked about that would have increased the supply side potential of the British economy and started to deal with our growth problems.
So we announced investment zones, which was essentially a planning reform in the mini budget. So we did do significant planning reform. And the fundamental idea behind investment zones is that rather than having the very long-winded, litigious planning process we currently have for building houses and businesses and industrial sites, instead, a local authority has a tax incentive to implement a planning zone, which is what countries that get much faster house building do. It's essentially pre-approved planning. So we did that. We had a way of delivering that. We did as much as we could on planning in the mini budget. But on fracking, I mean, the fracking in the United States has transformed their economy. It's one of the reasons why GDP per capita in the US is so much higher than it is in the United Kingdom, because their energy prices are half what people are in the UK. And one thing that really...
You're completely right that fracking has did massively boost the growth prospects. But it has a completely different geology to the UK and much less population density than the UK. It's a completely different structure.
But a fracking well doesn't actually have much on the ground infrastructure. You know, most of the work is underground when you're fracking for gas. And there are plenty of oil exploration outfits who will tell you there is a wide availability of gas under the United Kingdom.
Are you saying that British people who are really worried about the earth tremors, which they felt with even minimal drilling, are just wrong?
What I'm saying is I don't feel on these environmental questions, the real trade-offs are presented to people. So if you gave people a choice of would you allow fracking in your area and have half your gas bill cost half what it does today, people might change their view. But the problem is people are just presented with the negative side and not the positive side. It's a bit like house building. Do you want a house built in your backyard? Well, no, I don't. Do you want somewhere your grandchild can afford to live locally? Yes, I do. And I think British politics and British political journalism, with you as the exception, Robert, has been very, very poor at presenting what is the coherent argument. And of course, in order to see whether or not the UK does have massive fracking potential, you need to get on with it. You know, we know there is gas under the UK. There's also a problem that we're not exploiting our North Sea reserves enough. And this is why I wanted to remove the windfall tax and make it easier for licensing to take place in the North Sea.
But why not make it much easier to build wind farms, for example? I very rarely hear you say, we've got to have loads more wind farms.
I signed up to having more wind farms. I completely support building renewable energy as well. I support building nuclear energy. I want Britain to become a net energy exporter, which will be a combination of renewables, oil and gas and nuclear. I'm very, very supportive of that. But the easiest thing to make a difference in the short term is through gas, both offshore gas and onshore gas through fracking. And what I feel about the political and economic debate in this country is, you know, we do have 45% of spending on the government of our total national income, because our national income has not been rising enough. And there are too few people who are actually prepared to look at what are the reasons for that. One of the big reasons is energy costs. Another big reason is the planning system. Another big reason is the sheer level of regulation that we have in this country. We left the European Union, but we've still got the vast majority of European Union laws on our statute books. So these are the difficult things we're going to have to deal with if we want our country to be successful.
And just to be clear, there are going
to
be lots of...
And those are not easy arguments to make.
No, they're not easy
arguments. In a six-week leadership election with 2 years to a general election. And this is why I'm saying maybe it was just a very difficult task to make that stuff happen in that short period of time. But the idea that we could have done the supply side reforms whilst putting up taxes strikes me as... it pretty bonkers.
But you're basically saying you were finished whatever happened, which, you know, I'm trying to give you the benefit of the doubt that there was a way of managing this that could have seen you survive.
I think, well, first of all, I was finished because of the LDI issue, which needs to be properly investigated.
I need to make 2 points here. I mean, one is just a simple point that there will be lots of young people in particular listening saying that you simply don't take the environmental costs of, you know, North Sea exploration and fracking seriously enough. But there is a second point. This is really at the heart of some of what you've been arguing. The Bank of England has independent responsibility for controlling inflation. Now, it's a perfectly plausible argument to say that they were way too late in putting up interest rates, and that made our inflation problem worse in the UK. And I think they were too late in putting up interest rates. But let's be absolutely clear about what was happening apart from the LDI-related forced sales of government bonds that were pushing up interest rates. You, Kwasi, announced a massive stimulus, okay? This was a stimulus budget. When governments announce a stimulus, the response of the Bank of England is to assess whether that's going to increase inflation. And chances are your budget was going to increase inflation. And what investors immediately think when they see a stimulus of this sort is that interest rates are going to go up, because truthfully, Bank of England was likely to put up interest rates even more in the wake of your budget. So the difficulty that you had at the time, independent of whether LDI had been there or not, is yes, you were cutting taxes. You weren't cutting taxes that much for most people, but most people anyway were going to see a rise in interest rates. And in particular, they were going to see a rise in mortgage rates that was directly linked to your mini budget. So you are saying you couldn't afford to wait to cut taxes. But the reality is, in cutting taxes in the way that you did, you were making yourself politically incredibly unpopular, because even without LDI, people would have said you and Kwasi were responsible for mortgage rates going up.
Well, I mean, mortgage rates were going up and went up around the world, and, you know, in a comparable way to what happened in the United Kingdom. I mean, it was a particular spike.
But that was only after the mini budget was reversed.
There was a particular spike, which is as a result of the turmoil around LDIs. That was what caused that spike. Now, on the question of whether tax cuts are inflationary, you know, I believe inflation is a monetary phenomenon, and the Bank of England has moved away from that. You know, their model of inflation contained no reference to the money supply. And the reason that we had such high inflation in the UK is because the Bank of England failed to control the money supply and didn't put interest rates up enough.
I mean, certainly the Bank of England misunderstood the stimulus that took place in COVID and what impact that would have on inflation at a time when the supply side was being constricted also by COVID.
This was a pro-supply side budget. So things like reducing corporation tax, I do not believe is inflationary. It's actually increasing supply.
But Liz, what you believe is neither here nor there. Investors saw that budget as inflationary, and therefore they set market interest rates at a higher level. So it's all very well to say you don't believe in the long run it would have been inflationary. That's not what matters if you are the Prime Minister at a time when interest rates are going up, because they're going up and people are going to blame you.
But what I'm saying is the economic orthodoxy in Britain, as thought of in the Treasury, in the Bank of England, in the Office of Budget Responsibility, no doubt in many places in the city, has become very Keynesian. And I believe them to be wrong. And did I realise quite how Keynesian they were? Maybe I didn't. But I still don't agree that not raising corporation tax is inflationary. I don't agree with them. You know, this is why I'm saying
whether
that
it's Keynesian or not, even I think even Patrick Minford is going to, I think, agree that an unfunded tax cut is going to stimulate the economy in an inflationary way. So, I cannot believe he would disagree with that.
You'll have to ask Patrick Minford on this show, and I'm sure he'll give you a very good answer on that. But the reason that interest rates have been going up is that they were too low for too long, and our monetary policy is bad. And I think one of the many problems with the way the Bank of England was made independent is these issues about interest rates, their impact on mortgage rates, how the economy works, are not widely enough understood. And too many governments claim that they're responsible for inflation. The government is not responsible for inflation. The Bank of England literally has the inflation mandate. The problem is that our current system does not hold them sufficiently to account for that. So politicians seem to have outsourced all the power, but taken all the blame for everything that happens. And why are interest rates on mortgages higher than they were? The answer is that interest rates were too low for too long. And the fact that the LDIs were baked into the system, which were essentially predicated on low interest rates, shows that there was an overall system problem of people believing the cheap money would go on forever. And it wasn't going to go on forever. That was very clear. But I don't think that politicians or the Bank of England themselves have been honest enough with the public about that.
So we're on the cliff edge. Your period in office is not quite over. And so we've still got to learn who it was who killed you as Prime Minister. And I'm absolutely certain that in our next episode, we will learn who the guilty party was. Join me then.